On this week's 51%, a professor and researcher on topics related to Title IX and sexual assault publishes a letter to her stalker.
What I needed to be able to do was treat him like he was a man at a bar that was bothering me. But nothing I did would allow me to treat my professor, who had all this power over me, like some annoying man in the bar.
And a woman talks about living under a VA tent. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I am now a central part of your mind's landscape, whether you care or do not. Yeah, I've made up your mind. The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
2 years. That's how long Donna Freitas' graduate school mentor, a priest and celebrated scholar, stalked her. Last year, Freitas released her book, Consent, a memoir of unwanted attention. She says writing the memoir made her feel more powerful than she'd ever felt, and she wasn't afraid of him anymore. After years of fearing contact with her stalker, she was ready to speak directly to him. Her newest publication, Dear Professor, a woman's letter to her stalker, allows her to do just that. Freitas spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her memoir Consent and how it led to her new letter, Dear Professor.
My memoir tells the story of what happened during grad school. I was very excited to be going to get my PhD. It was my dream in life to become a professor, like the wonderful professors I'd had growing up and when I was in college. And so I ended up in this PhD program, and while I was there, one of my professors, who was the head of my concentration and who should have been my dissertation director, became obsessed with me, for lack of a better word. And so the memoir tells the story of the transition of me going from being very excited to have this professor be excited about me as a student to really becoming horrified by him and his behavior and the ways in which he found his way into my life in every direction he could possibly find, and all the consequences it had for me in my life, both then but also still now, over 20 years later.
Do you think it was your faith in the religious and educational institutions you grew up with that made you more susceptible to the trauma that you suffered? And if so, why?
Faith is a complicated question for me. It's not so much that I had faith in my family's religious tradition. I grew up in the context of it. But it was a huge part of my family and upbringing, and I was raised to respect the people within the church. So it certainly was a hurdle, but I would say that the biggest hurdle for me was the fact that I believed wholeheartedly and without reservation in my professors and in their goodness, I guess. And I was lucky to have these wonderful teachers when I was growing up. My mother was a teacher. I was surrounded by teachers. I had the most extraordinary college professors. And I just really fell in love with that role. And I was so grateful to all of my teachers and professors for what they brought to me, their faith in me as a thinker and as someone with potential to be a professor someday, to use my brain in these really complicated ways. And so I really believed in the university and in the professor with my whole heart. And I trusted them wholeheartedly also. And I think ultimately that was my undoing with this professor. It was so hard for me to doubt his goodness in the beginning. It took a lot of abuse and inappropriate behavior on his part to get me to that place.
How do you think men handle unwanted attention differently than women?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't know if men experience that in the same way that women do. I think men aren't raised to understand themselves as objects in the ways that women are, or the ways that women are enculturated to see themselves. And I think men are raised to see women as objects. And so I'm not sure how they experience it. But I think women always have this sense when they're out in the world that they may receive a certain kind of attention, or they have to be careful about the kind of attention they may elicit from someone or a group of someones. And so I think it's part of a woman's awareness in general. And one of the things that this experience made me think so much about is how unthinking I was at the time that this happened. How I think I really believed I could move through the world and control the attention that I was getting. And so this was a truly rude awakening when I couldn't control this person, or I couldn't stop this person from paying me this attention I didn't want, no matter what I did.
When you came forward, was there a disbelief around the trauma that you were suffering?
I don't even know if I knew I was traumatized at the time. I was now looking back, but I just sort of couldn't believe that this thing was happening, and all I wanted to do was make it stop. And I believed that if I could just make it stop, everything was going to be fine. Like, my life was going to go back to where it was. I really didn't understand that it might never go back to where it was. And so what was clear when I came forward, you know, there were many stages of my coming forward, I guess. So, you know, initially, when I first told a friend, and then we told a professor, and then we had to tell the chair of my department, there was just incredible relief. No one doubted me or my story, partly because I had so much evidence. So, yeah. And that was incredible to not be alone in the secret that I had anymore. But when I eventually had to come forward to my university, because no matter what I did, I couldn't stop this man's behavior. It just kept going. It didn't really matter who I told. He kept doing these things and trying to be part of my life. The university, I don't know what they believed, but I know now that they saw me as the threat, and they saw their job as protecting him and their reputation. And so, you know, I said earlier that I believed with my whole heart in the goodness of the university and the professor. And this was one of the most heartbreaking experiences I've ever had in my life, because that university I trusted so much betrayed me. When I came forward to my university, this was just a few years after Anita Hill. Okay. So this was a really long time ago. No one was talking about sexual harassment. Very little conversation was happening about sexual violence in general. You know, this is before the Catholic abuse scandal. This is way before us talking about Title IX, about Me Too. You know, we're talking ages ago. And so I don't even really think people thought about women and whether or not they should be believed. They just weren't thinking about this issue in general. And I didn't know how to think about it either. I don't think the word sexual harassment even were terms in my vocabulary at that time. And I know now that that's what this was. It was, you know, an extended experience of sexual harassment that went on for over 2 years, a very, very intense one. But at the time, I couldn't even put words to what was happening. I was almost afraid to, because the accusation just felt so enormous. I believed I might be the only person that this was happening to. We didn't really talk about those things publicly. And so it felt like I must be completely alone and having this happen. And so I don't know that people really thought about it. But what I do know is that once I articulated this to my university, I was regarded as a threat. I don't think they thought about whether or not it was true. I think they just jumped to, how can we get this woman out of here?
When you originally wrote Consent, what were your hopes for the memoir?
I don't think I had any hopes. I mean, when I became this writer person, and I had been a writer for a really long time before I started the document that became my memoir. But it never occurred to me that I was going to write a memoir about this thing. even though I teach classes on memoir and creative nonfiction, like it never occurred to me that I would write about this. And even when I opened the document and started writing, I wasn't sure if I was going to follow through. It wasn't until I was about halfway finished with writing my memoir that I thought, okay, you know, I'm doing this. Like I'm going to finish this. And when I was almost done, Me Too happened. And so I was writing this whole thing before all the accusations came out about Harvey Weinstein. And when that happened and I was almost done, I wonder if this will get published. Like maybe this is really going to happen. Yeah. And I think what I wanted to do when I started writing the memoir was I really wanted to analyze what had happened. I wanted to speak to the fact that despite the fact that part of my PhD is in gender studies and I teach on these subjects, that, you know, I still feel like a victim and have all of this shame and blame. And one of the things I said in the memoir was I'm my own greatest victim blamer. And I think that that is a truth that I have reckoned with. And I do this thing where I make myself sort of step outside myself and talk to myself as though I am a professor, you know, talking to one of my students and right. say, Donna Freitas, like, this was not your fault. And, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. But there's also, I became this person who speaks about sex and sexual harassment and sexual violence and consent on campus. And I've been really frustrated with our conversations around this topic. I feel like they're often not very honest and they don't really consider the incredible complexity of what it means to say no to someone who has a lot of power over you, like how hard that is. And also what it means to withdraw consent from what was a consensual relationship. That is part of what I have struggled with for years. The fact that when my relationship with this professor started, and by relationship, I mean professor-student relationship, you know, just a basic professor-student relationship. Right. And I went to his office hours all the time. Like I cultivated that relationship in the beginning. And, you know, once it started going in a different direction, I literally didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to... What I needed to be able to do was treat him like he was a man at a bar that was bothering me. But nothing I did would allow me to treat my professor who had all this power over me like some annoying man in the bar.
Yeah.
And I think often, you know, what we do in culture now when we talk about consent, we reduce it to this, like, you should say yes enthusiastically or no enthusiastically. And I just don't buy that it's that easy. You know, I think getting over the hurdle of somehow, you know, telling someone with that much power over you, no, get away from me, is a really enormous task. And for me to actually do that in the position I was in, I had to get to this place where I was willing to lose everything I had ever hoped for myself, that I just didn't care anymore if I lost it. And so when I wrote the memoir, I thought, I want to really talk about how hard that was and how we need to have more complex conversations about this issue because we're oversimplifying it.
Why did you decide that the conversation needed to continue in Dear Professor, A Woman's Letter to Her Stalker?
I began to think about what I would say to this man today, if I could. And I fantasized a lot about him encountering the memoir somehow and realizing that I had written about him. I think for a very long time, I just felt so afraid of contact with him, as though he could still hurt me. And I think writing the memoir made me feel more power than I've ever felt in my life. And I know that sounds cheesy, but it's true. That's how it made me feel. And I also felt so proud of it. Like I had taken the ugliest thing that had ever happened to me and turned it into something beautiful, that I had become this person, this literary person who was capable of doing that. And so I started to realize that I wasn't really afraid of him anymore. And I also began to think that soon he would die because he's old.
Yeah.
And I would be really upset if he died. And I didn't get to say these things to him. My agent had said, she asked me if I wanted to participate in this series of letters that were going to be published. And I thought, no, I don't know. I don't know if that's right for me. And then one morning I woke up and I just thought, I know how I would start that letter. And I started writing. And I wrote in a kind of fugue state. Like all of this stuff just came spilling out. And it felt really good to write it. But I think one of the strangest things for me, or maybe one of the most interesting things for me, was to see how different the voice, my voice, is in the letter than it is in the memoir.
How so?
And in the letter, it's so much angrier and sarcastic. And I think there's bitterness there too. It's just such a different tone. And I think the memoir, when I look at the memoir, it makes me incredibly sad. I think there's incredible urgency in the memoir that I see. And I think there's a lot of desperation and sadness. But that letter is really angry. One of the things that was so unexpected about it, but I think has meant so much to me, has been how many letters I've received, long letters from people about their own experiences, but also all those letters, every one of them, somewhere they say, I'm so sorry, Donna, for what happened to you. I don't think I realized how much I was yearning to hear sorry until that started to happen. And it made me think so much about the fact that I never, ever got a sorry after this happened. All I got was a silencing. And it's been extraordinary to have someone say they're sorry, because this whole time and still now, I'm so full of doubt about what happened and, you know, the fact that I made this accusation and you know, it changed my life. And I think there's something about those sorries that tell me and affirm for me, yes, Donna, what happened to you was wrong. And, you know, you deserve an apology from someone. And it's sad that the apologies are coming from the people who do not need to apologize.
Right.
But I am still really grateful for them.
What are your thoughts on forgiveness or outing your stalker by name, which you have avoided in print and at readings and lectures?
I haven't named him ever in public, and I have no intention of doing that. A lot of people have pressured me to, and it took me a long time to realize why I haven't named him and, you know, why I was so resistant to doing that. And it has to do with the fact that I think one of the things that happens when we name our accusers is that the story becomes about them, which bothers me. And, you know, we still listen to women when they name people, but we get really, I think, invested and fascinated by the accusers. And sometimes I think they eclipse the accusations themselves. And one of the things that is really important to me is to never allow my public person to be associated with that man. He followed me around for nearly 3 years and made my life a living hell. He was all I could see. He was a 24/7 job. And I don't want to be associated with his person. And it's my right not to be. It would break my heart to see my photo, for example, next to his on some article. that someone wrote about my memoir. He doesn't belong there. You know, this was my chance to use my voice to tell my side of the story. And that's the only side that gets to be told right now, as far as I'm concerned. And so by denying speaking his name, I'm also denying him a voice.
That was author and scholar Donna Freitas speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill. Freitas's new publication is Dear Professor, A Woman's Letter to Her Stalker. It is published by Scribd. In Los Angeles, the Department of Veterans Affairs is trying a new way to help homeless veterans. It's allowing them to live in tents on the VA campus, where they can also receive food, health care, and other services. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues, it's a model that could expand outside the VA. Matt Tinoco reports for the American Homefront Project.
By any metric, it's like the countless other homeless camps around Los Angeles, a collection of a few dozen tents propped up on a parking lot, most draped with blue tarps. But there's also porta potties, hand washing stations, and on-site medical staff. The tents are spaced apart, maybe about 12 feet. Lisa Tompkins is one of the only women there and has been homeless for a long time.
It's been a struggle for the last 19 years, but I'm sober today and I'm happy today and I'm walking in peace today.
She's been there on the West LA VA's Verdant campus since April, when the VA of Greater Los Angeles opened the camp. She showed up after she was asked to leave one of LA's largest homeless shelters at the onset of the pandemic, where she'd been for about a year.
There was some issues with social distancing and face mask wearing, and I found myself all of a sudden without a place to go.
As a former Air Force medic, she could turn to the VA for resources. And when she showed up, she was offered a space in the camp.
They have, you know, round-the-clock security, case management on site, they have nurse practitioners on site.
Officially, the camp is the Care Treatment Rehabilitation Services Program, the CTRS in federal acronym speak. It's one of few such sites in California, basically a stopgap to give vets who were showing up at the VA asking for help, like Tompkins, somewhere to go during the pandemic. Dr. Anjani Reddy is clinical director for the LA VA's homeless program.
This really did seem like the right time to jump into action and provide the service.
In the hierarchy of basic needs, the CTRS takes care of some of the most fundamental. 3 meals a day, water on tap, bathrooms, trash services, and the security of a federal campus. None of those things are ever easily accessible for people living outside.
We continue to move them towards stable housing, but we recognize that that's limited right now and it may be limited more in the future.
Southern California's homelessness crisis continues to worsen and has jumped another 13% since last year. It has some thinking the sanctioned camp model piloted at the VA could become an option for LA's population of non-veteran homeless. That includes a federal judge who's overseeing a lawsuit filed by advocates and property owners who say LA's government has handled mass homelessness with negligence. That judge has ordered the city to shelter thousands in just a few months, potentially in sanctioned campsites. Michelle Martinez is special advisor to the court in that case.
This is a rebirth. This is a renewal. We're going to have to do things differently.
At the same time, and despite some successful experiments, many in and out of government are reluctant to embrace safe campsites because, well, it seems like giving up. The people in them are still homeless, still in tents, still outside, and still without indoor plumbing. But for Lisa Tompkins, the camp at the West LA VA is better than a camp somewhere else.
It's not ideal, no. But I'm making it work. I've got my pink comforter in here, and I got my unicorn squishmallow for a pillow.
It's a work in progress. No on-site showers mean coordinating a ride to the nearby YMCA. It took 2 weeks to figure out access to electrical outlets for charging cell phones. But for Tompkins, the camp is still a step up.
You know, I'm grateful. Rather than focus on what they didn't do, I'd really like focusing on what a benefit this is to me.
It's the simple thing she appreciates the most, like a small water bottle station and easy access to ice cubes for a chilled drink. I'm Matt Tinoco in Los Angeles.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. University of Minnesota professor Brenda Child heard a story growing up on the Red Lake Reservation about a sick girl and the vision her father received of a dress and a dance that would, and did, heal her. Professor Child wanted to know if that story gave a clue to the origins of the Ojibwe jingle dress and dance of healing during the Spanish flu epidemic. Here's Britt Amott.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Was the Jingle Dance a response to the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918? That's what University of Minnesota professor Brenda Child wanted to know. There were no known photographs of Ojibwe women wearing the distinctive jingle dress with its rows of metal jingles sewn on the skirt before 1920. And there was also a story Brenda Child had heard growing up on the Red Lake Reservation of a girl from the Mille Lacs Ojibwe community who fell gravely ill. Her father, in a dream, received a vision that revealed a dance and a dress that would cure her. So the father made the dress, and the daughter put it on and danced the dance he'd seen in the dream. And step by step, she grew stronger, finally recovering. Could that story also have been about the Spanish flu epidemic? All that Professor Child knew was that by 1918, Spanish flu appeared, and nearly 1 in 4 Native Americans living on a reservation would become infected, and 2% of them die. Not long after that, Ojibwe women in Minnesota and Ontario began sewing jingle dresses and performing the jingle dance for healing.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1619.